As uploaded to YouTube October 8, 2011 by sustainabilityconference.org and localfuture.org, this is Nicole Foss, the senior editor from The Automatic Earth. The title is How I Prepared My Home for Peak Oil and Economic Uncertainty.
I welcome you back to the 2010 International Conference on Sustainability, Energy, Economy, and Environment. This morning, our third day, we have the pleasure of hearing from Ms. Nicole Foss of Ottawa, Canada. She is the senior editor for the website The Automatic Earth, which is one of the largest financial news sites on the Internet. It's a very interesting site because every two or three days they post a new page, and the new page is a compilation of all the most interesting news regarding finance in the world. And you don't have to click on 100 links to go read the articles. All the articles are right there. I think that might be possible because the editor lives in a foreign country, and that's copyright laws are not necessarily enforced in the same way. But everything is linked and sourced and everything.
This is not me that is the editor.
Yeah, it's not her. It's not her.
My writing partner in Holland.
So please welcome back to the stage Ms. Nicole Foss.
So what I thought I would do today, rather than do a sort of formal presentation, is just talk about personal preparation and to start with, look at what we did and why we did it. And then look at some of the general principles about what it is that people can do. And perhaps look at different circumstances that people may be facing in terms of urban or rural, or whether they have more money or less money, and or what age they are, what their vulnerabilities are. So we were living, 10 years ago, we were living in England, my family and I, and we had quite a nice house in England, but it didn't have an awful lot of land, as is typical for England. Land is unbelievably expensive. England was in a massive property bubble even then. And we were looking at a situation where England is 60 million people on a little tiny island, and its only means of support are North Sea oil and gas, and money chasing its own tail in the financial district of the City of London. Both of those are going away. They've offshored almost everything. Manufacturing is gutted. There is almost no other means of support. North Sea oil and gas is depleting at double-digit percentages per year. When we have moved really into financial crisis, the City of London is going to stop spinning off money into the southeast. There's just going to be no visible means of support in England, and with 60 million people on an island. And it's also the surveillance nation of the world, by the way. There are CCTV cameras absolutely everywhere. So I was thinking, all right, well, there's not enough to go around. There isn't going to be any means to even afford to import goods from other places because there'll be no means to earn the money to do so. There isn't going to be the ability to perhaps even heat homes or provide for electricity. We'd had what they called the dash for gas in England, by which it was, the conversion of our electricity infrastructure from coal to natural gas, which we are now having to import, England is now having to import from Russia. And Russia likes yanking Europe's chain. So, and England is at the wrong end of the supply line. Already there's very little gas pressure in the pipeline when it's cold on the continent, even before Russia turns the taps off. So we were thinking, this is not a good place to be. It really isn't. And so we decided to leave 10 years ago. Because England was in such a massive property bubble, everything we had was tied up in the house. We wouldn't have had any freedom of action to do really anything. You could not be self-sufficient. There was simply no money left over to do anything else besides own a home. And for a lot of people, even that was challenging. So we simply liquidated everything we had, and we moved to somewhere an awful lot cheaper, which in our case was Ottawa, Canada, where I grew up and I had family, and where it was possible to buy a 40-acre farm for half what I sold my townhouse in Kenilworth for. It's a one-way trip. You can never go home again, but I wasn't planning to go back there anyway. So now we ended up in Ontario, on a farm in Ontario, and ended up thinking, well, now what do we do with it? So we've spent the last 10 years putting in the infrastructure for an element of self-sufficiency. We have no pretense to being completely self-sufficient, but we're doing what we can, and we're not too far out of town. It's not like we have to be 100% self-sufficient because we don't live completely in the back of beyond. It's about a half-hour drive for me to the center of the capital. So although I do live in a rural area on a farm, I'm not that remote. So we looked at energy to start with. The house came with an old geothermal system, a terribly old and inefficient one, unfortunately, but the electricity demand was very high. The geothermal system couldn't keep the house warm by itself, so it was supplemented with electric heating. It's a sort of L-shaped house. It's 100 years old, so it's not as well insulated as it might be, and it has a high surface area to volume. So basically the heating costs were really, really high, and a lot of them were electric. So what we did, we decided that we were going to take a look at all our energy use. We were going to drop our demand by 90% and then attempt to supply what was left. And that sounds extreme, but it was actually really quite doable. And how doable it is will depend on the property that you happen to be in. For our property, it was stop using the geothermal system for heating because it's once through. So it means all the time it's bringing water up from 140 feet down our well, up through, dump it down again, constantly doing that. That's not the way to run a geothermal system. That's not the way modern ones are. Modern ones would have a lot of horizontal piping buried under the ground, so you would not be pumping over that kind of distance. So we stopped using that. We removed the supplementary electric heat. We put in a fireplace insert, a really efficient fireplace insert in the living room, but that's not enough to keep the whole house warm except in the shoulder seasons. So we put in an outdoor wood-burning furnace. So it's a firebox surrounded by a skin of hot water, and then you can run hot water loops to wherever you want them. So you can heat multiple dwellings or multiple structures. And what we do with ours, we have three loops off ours, one that runs the space heating in our home, one that runs the hot water, it runs a heat exchange through the hot water tank, and then one that heats the greenhouse that we built right next to the outdoor wood-burning furnace. So there's a second concrete pad with a greenhouse. There's a heat loop that runs from the wood stove round the inside of the greenhouse because you really, really want a longer growing season than you get in Ottawa, Canada. So that it wouldn't mean that we could grow food all year round, but it would certainly extend the growing season. So putting heat there was useful as well. So that was the main thing we did to start with, to get the electricity demand down, the energy demand down. And we have no oil or gas, natural gas use on our property at all. So what we have now is heat is wood, combined with solar domestic hot water, by the way, for hot water in the summer, because we don't run the wood stove in the summer. If you run those big wood stoves in the summer, what you get is the fire is constantly damped down and you produce masses of creosote, which is not something you want to do. So the wood stove outside is for winter. We don't turn it on until it gets to about freezing. If it's below freezing, then we will run the outdoor wood stove. If it's above freezing, then we will cope with the wood stove in the living room, and parts of the house will be kind of cold, and we wear sweaters and sleep under lots of blankets, which is entirely doable. So in the winter, you know, our hot water comes from the wood. In the summer, it comes from a solar domestic hot water system. So we undersized that for five people because we were only looking to use it for hot water in the summer, not for any space heating and not for any hot water contribution in the winter, because we didn't want the solar domestic hot water and the wood stove to be fighting each other anyway. So we have a system that provides all the heat that we need with nothing more than wood and sun. A fair amount of work involved with wood, and they say that it keeps you warm multiple times, you know, when you cut it and when you stack it and when you burn it, and, which is perfectly true. And the nice thing about the outdoor wood-burning furnaces is you don't need to use split firewood. So we developed some serious muscles hefting around chunks of hardwood that are this long and this big around. But it can be done. You have to do it twice a day, though. So you're out there in the morning, whatever the temperature or the conditions, you're out there throwing wood in the wood stove in the morning and then again in the evening. And if it's really, really cold, if it's minus 30, whatever that is, seriously cold, but and minus 40 is the same for both temperature scales, so minus 30 Celsius is slightly warmer than minus 40 Fahrenheit, but it's really, really cold anyway. So if it's that cold, especially if there's a wind, then we're throwing in an extra load of wood in the middle of the day. But fairly large chunks of hardwood. It's a fairly big wood dependency, but at least we're dependent on something that we have. I mean, not that we have our own wood lot because it's a farm, but wood is everywhere where we live. And so although if everybody turned to wood, the wood wouldn't last very long, nevertheless, it's better to be dependent on something that you have where you are than something that has to come from a very long way away. And we do have, actually, equipment to do wood without a chainsaw. I'm sure we would have our house an awful lot colder if we had to do that, because if you're talking about providing firewood with a two-man crosscut saw, you know, that's a serious undertaking. We would probably simply wall off one wing of our house and not use it in the winter and all huddle around the fire in the living room or something, but it could be done. The other aspect of energy, apart from the heat, we put in a renewable energy system. So we have, once we had dropped our demand, by the way, so we've got efficient appliances, some things we don't use appliances for, we dealt with the heat issue, got rid of the electric heatings. We did drop our demand 90%. Then we attempted to supply what was left. We put in a renewable energy system. So we have 3 kilowatts of solar panels in our backfield behind the barn. And we have a battery bank in our basement, 6 deep cycle marine batteries. Those are wired up to run the essentials 24 hours a day. So if the mains went down, we wouldn't even notice from the point of view of the essentials. There are a lot of things we wouldn't have. What we did is we looked at our demands and we said, which are things that are truly essential? So for us, that was the well pump, the sump pump without which the basement would flood, fridge, freezers, the security system, the invisible fence for the dogs that keeps them from going and eating our sheep, and a number of things like that are fairly basic. A couple of fans, a few lights, a few sockets in sort of one part of the house. Not an awful lot. And people really need to think if they're going to put in renewable energy, they're not going to be able to supply very much demand compared to what they're used to. Because renewable energy systems are expensive, and you really start to think about what you're using the energy for when you have to shell out to pay for it in advance. Pay for 30 years worth of electricity, essentially, in advance. So it only runs the essentials, but it runs them 24 hours a day. The next most essential raft of things are wired up to run off a generator panel. So we have a gasoline generator and a diesel generator that we attach to our tractor. We can run from the tractor. The battery bank can be charged with either the mains, either one of the generators, or the solar panels. So this is a question of building in redundancy and flexibility. So if you don't know what your inputs are going to be, see if there's a way you can figure it out so that whichever inputs you have, you can make it work one way or another. So we wanted to have multiple ways to charge the battery bank. We did not grid tie our panels, by the way. Now, had we done so, the Ontario government would pay us 82 cents a kilowatt hour for our electricity through the feed-in tariff system. However, personally, I think those contracts have a snowball's chance in hell of lasting 20 years. They've been promised to last for 20 years. I think they're going to become so politically inconvenient that there will be a mandate generated, which would be simple to do, to repudiate the contracts unilaterally, as completely illegal as that would be. Nevertheless, I expect it to happen. So I did not put these panels in to generate money in my backfield, which is what I would be doing if I went for the feed-in tariff. You are not allowed to have a storage component, an energy storage component, if you have a feed-in tariff contract. You have to sell everything you produce to the grid, then you buy back what you use for less. So you have built a money-generating machine. You will have no more energy when the mains go down than anybody else who does not have renewable energy. So to me, that completely defeats the purpose of a renewable energy project. I do not grid-tie my panels. The other thing that comes to mind, of course, is that if something is grid-tied, then what you produce can be commandeered for the public good. Of course, it wouldn't do the public any good at all because there's so little of it. But I want to make sure that we have the energy that we paid for 30 years in advance. So it is not possible to export that energy from where we produce it to anywhere else. So it simply feeds our battery bank. And we did not go for a tracker, by the way. There are various arguments about going for solar panels on trackers. But trackers are moving parts. Trackers tend to be the weak point in a solar array. So anything that's moving parts is a vulnerability. It can go wrong. Often they're under-engineered. Yes, you get more energy out of your panels if you can shift them for the sun during the day. But we simply decided not to do that. We put in more panels instead. And we can shift them a little bit. We can change the angle. So we can set it as a steep angle. They're just oriented to the south, but we can set it at a steep angle for winter and then a shallow angle for summer. And we would do marginally better if we shifted the angle four times or three times a year rather than just once. But at the moment, the difference is marginal enough that we haven't bothered to do that. So no moving parts. One of the reasons we didn't do a wind turbine as well is the idea of moving parts being a vulnerability. There's not a lot of wind energy density where we are anyway, so it wasn't a terribly realistic option. You can do it, but the capital cost of the wind and the solar will be about the same, and 85% of the energy will come from the solar system. So it didn't seem to make sense. Plus, I didn't fancy the idea of shinnying up a 100-foot wind turbine tower to knock off the uneven icing after an ice storm before a windstorm that would have ripped the thing to shreds. So in our personal, our environment, there were significant disadvantages to thinking about wind. Nevertheless, with solar, there is the dark trimester where we are, with, you know, October, November, December, there's almost no sun. So then you're dependent on either the mains or a generator. So that is a vulnerability. We are still connected to the mains. It costs vastly less to supply 100% of your power than it does to supply merely, say, 90% of it. So we're right near a road, we kept the mains connection. So that allows us to have a third raft of things above and beyond the things that are on the generator panel, things like our electric range and, you know, some of more appliances that we could perfectly well do without if we had to. But it's nice to have them while we can. So there are certain things we would only have if we have mains power. Now, to look at another example of resilience from redundancy, if you think about cooking, you know, identify an essential function, like charging my batteries was one, cooking is another. How many different ways could I cook depending on what inputs I have? Well, right now I cook on an electric range, typically. But I wouldn't have that if I didn't have mains power. I could use my smaller toaster oven, which is less of a draw, but still, I probably wouldn't want to run that from a generator. So, because anything that generates heat is a big electricity draw. So I would probably use neither of the electric appliances that actually produce heat. I could use a microwave run by my generator. I could use the wood-fired AGA. It's a wood range. It's an old one. It's a 1928 wood range in my kitchen. Came with the house. I didn't have to buy it. So I could certainly do that. I could cook with propane on a barbecue. I could cook with butane on a Coleman stove. I could cook in a solar oven. Or I could go out into the middle of my driveway, create a fire pit. This is not an asphalt ordinary driveway, by the way. It's like a graveled courtyard. So I could simply go out there, set up a fire pit. I have a tripod and a Dutch oven, and I could cook over an open fire. So there are many, many ways of achieving exactly the same essential function. And we have redundancy. Those elements of redundancy were not even particularly expensive. I mean, things like solar cookers are, well, they do cost something, but they don't cost an absolute arm and a leg. So when it comes to preparedness, things like that are not that expensive are well worth considering. And another thing to absolutely think of is water, where water is coming from. For most of us, it's turn on the tap and we're on the municipal system. And I'm not suggesting that that's going to go away anytime soon, but the quality might deteriorate significantly because a lot of things have to be coordinated and go right to produce decent quality drinking water. So for a lot of people, I would argue the best thing you can have is a water filter, the kind the aid agencies use in the third world, where what you're doing in some of these places is the only water supply might be a surface water pond full of goat droppings or something like that. If you run it through one of these filter systems, you can drink that and you won't get sick. And it's completely passive, no power required, no chemicals. It's purely a physical process. So you can get hold of something like a Big Berkey, which is what I have. Two different kinds of filters you can use depending on how much you worry about what the water quality might be. There are white ceramic filters, which is what I use with my well water at the moment, just to take the iron and a little bit of sulfur out of it. If you were drinking something you had reason to be more concerned about, there are activated charcoal filters. The filters cost about $100, I think, for a set, which is not totally insignificant, obviously, but they last a long time. I'm still on my first set of filters, and it's been 3 years. So this is not a major, major expense. The water is important. So what I use is I have this filter, not because I couldn't drink what comes out of my well now, but at some point I may have water quality issues, and I wouldn't be able to test for water quality past a certain point. So I use these white ceramic filters right now. I also have on my property the old dug well, the 100-year-old dug well with the original 100-year-old pump handle, so I can go out there and do this. It's only 30 feet deep. I hate to think what's in that water. It doesn't smell very nice. If I was going to drink that, then I would certainly run it through activated charcoal filters first. There's no question that that would be absolutely necessary, or I would get sick from drinking that. But you can practically drink water out of puddles if you run it through an activated charcoal filter system. So it's definitely something to bear in mind. So you want to think of where your heat is coming from, where your power is coming from, where your water is coming from. What about transport? Well, I mean, where we live, we're about 3 kilometers from the nearest village. We all have bicycles. We can walk it. That's no problem. I run it periodically just for a bit of exercise, you know, generate a bit of internal heat. So it's not that far. We do have more of a transport vulnerability than people would if they lived in an urban area. But nevertheless, because we've eliminated so many other vulnerabilities, we reckon we just have to live with this one. Now, we can walk a lot further than 3 kilometers to the village. I could walk all the way into town if I was minded to do so. It's probably 20 kilometers, but, you know, that's doable. I could certainly do that on a bicycle. So I don't feel that we're that vulnerable because of where we live, because it's not that remote. So, and that sort of thing is very important as well. If you're in an urban area, an urban can work, by the way. I'm not suggesting by any means everyone has to go out and buy a farm and try and live in a rural area. That's not going to work for a lot of people. You can be urban or you can be rural. I think either one of those can work. It's what's in between that really doesn't. If you go for urban, then you can't really be self-sufficient. But the odds are that your centralized services are likely to survive. If they're going to survive anywhere, they'll survive there, because it doesn't take much to supply just a small core type area. So, I mean, that can work. Plus, you may be able to walk to everything that you need, so you don't have a transport vulnerability. You know, economic opportunities, such as they are, will be in cities. So will any relief programs that may be going. So for a lot of people, the urban option is going to be where they end up, which is exactly what happens all over the world these days. Rural poverty is pretty unforgiving, and people migrate to cities and end up living in these edge cities, barrios, favelas, whatever you want to call them. And the entire former middle class in Argentina now lives in Villas Miserias around Buenos Aires, which is the result of their financial crisis. But people typically do flock to cities. So a city is not necessarily a terrible option by any stretch of the imagination. There should be a lot of scope there. You can't be self-sufficient, but then you probably don't have to be. Whereas if you're in a rural area, you do. Or you have to be at least mostly self-sufficient. The trade-off is the centralized services are not likely to get out as far as you, but then you have the opportunity to be self-sufficient. But you really, really have to think about what you're going to do to cover all the bases, because there isn't necessarily a backup system from the top down to rescue you if you have somehow not managed to achieve that. So bear that in mind when you make the decision. The things that don't work are the things in between, where you have all of the vulnerabilities and none of the ability to do anything about any of them. So especially new suburbia. New suburbia is the most vulnerable. There's almost no land. There's probably no topsoil left. They probably scraped it all off before they built the houses. The houses thrown up quickly to profit off a housing boom are typically really badly built, so they can end up needing maintenance almost immediately. You need all of these life support systems that we have plugged ourselves into, whether it's snow removal, garbage removal, electricity, gas, water, and then education, healthcare, everything else. You're plugged into so many life support systems. You have no control over any of them. There's nothing you can do to be self-sufficient. So if you're in a place like that, you're probably in the wrong place. Parts of older suburbia are not necessarily that bad. Older suburbia, because they tend to be built, older suburban neighborhoods are built closer to the center anyway, then often that's good enough. And they have more land. They do have topsoil. They're often really well-established neighborhoods as well. And that's incredibly important. You really need other people to work with. Now, if you're in an urban area, social capital is simple enough. I mean, you have people all around you. Go out and meet them, work with them, get together, do almost any project to work with them, and you will build social capital, which is incredibly important. Where we are, we don't actually have neighbors, but what we're thinking, because we bought a place that had a lot of outbuildings, and outbuildings are essentially free, by the way. The property price tops out at a certain level, and then it doesn't matter what else is there. It just comes along for the ride. So we bought a 100-year-old farmhouse with 40 acres and 7 barns. So we have a lot of outbuildings that we can convert into additional accommodation. And we're basically thinking that we will at some point there have an intentional community, because we realize we cannot cover the entire skill base. There are quite a few things we can do, but we can't do everything. We don't have building skills, and we don't have mechanic-type skills or anything like that. And, you know, I can spin and weave and knit and sew and crochet and make clothes and all sorts of things like that, but I'm not that good at swinging a hammer, and I don't even make me touch a nail gun. So there are certain things. We have to know our limitations. So we would really need, if we were going to set up an intentional community there, we would really need to have more people there, people with a wider skill range. And we can grow things. We decided that we would be hobby farmers at least. So we don't have a commercial farm. We rent out a certain amount of land to a local farmer who often grows corn and pumpkins in rotation on it. We do our own hay. So we share haying equipment with a local farmer. And we have half a dozen sheep, a couple of alpacas, half a dozen chickens, and a dog sled team. So this is another aspect of transport, by the way, when there's no snow removal. We are mushers, so we can actually get around with a team of huskies and a sled, which we already have and know how to use. So that is something that is worth considering for the winter, because it does tend to be quite cold and snowy where we are. But we eat the sheep, we eat the surplus males, and then I have, the alpacas are fiber animals along with the rest of the sheep. And so if I ever get any time, then I may go back to doing fiber arts. I certainly have an enormous pile of fiber accumulating in my barn. So we have our own eggs because we have chickens. We don't eat the chickens. Chickens are too valuable for egg production. People need to think, if they're growing their own food, what it is they need to eat, what kind of nutritional basis they have to cover, and then what they can hope to store, and how they're going to store it, and what are the energy vulnerabilities of storage, for food storage. And we grow vegetables. We grow a three sisters pattern with corn and beans and squash. So the corn provides the structure, and then the beans grow around the corn and climb up the corn stalks. Beans, of course, being legumes, fix nitrogen in the soil. And then the squash plants just get so enormous they keep all the weeds down. We would also grow things like tomatoes and peppers and that sort of thing. So there's a fair amount we grow. But people need to think, especially in northern latitudes, with a short growing season, how are you going to feed yourself over the winter? So we've tried with a heated greenhouse, that will help. But it's, unfortunately for people who are vegan, it's going to be an awful lot harder to be vegetarian or vegan the further north you live, because food storage on the hoof doesn't cost you much in the way of energy in the way that a lot of other forms of food storage do. So if you live as far north as the Inuit, it's an entirely animal diet. If you live in southern Florida, you can absolutely be vegan. Anywhere in between, you may find down the line that you might have to come to a compromise, and you may simply have no choice. So think about the role of animals, and there's a big difference between, say, grass-fed beef and corn-fed beef. You can make an argument that if you're feeding cows corn, then yes, you could have fed the people corn, and it's a waste of energy to feed the corn to the cows. But people don't eat grass. There are a lot of places where the land is marginal, and there's not much you can do with it besides pasture. And when people make the argument that you should always eat what the animals ate instead, you know, if you eat the food instead of the animal eating the food, then you lose a lot less energy. And I think, oh, were you going to follow my sheep around the yard and pick the bugs out of their poop like my chickens do? You know, I don't think so. So my chickens are not competing with me for a food source, but they will use that food source that I wouldn't eat no matter how desperate I was. They will turn that into eggs for me. And eggs are a perfect source of protein and dietary fat. So this sort of thing, animals really do have a place in a system, provided we don't do the whole industrial system that has so much of a downside. If we do this on a human scale, then I would argue there's really nothing wrong with farming that incorporates animals. My chickens run around all over the place. They hide under the hedge. Sometimes people who come to visit me get surprised by hedge-dwelling chickens suddenly making an appearance right in front of the car, but we haven't lost any yet. So, yeah, they just potter around, and the sheep have a large expanse as well. So I don't think we're badly treating animals at all. And, you know, it seems to be a system that is working. If you have grass-fed animals, then you will end up with the right balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids in the animal tissues. And that is incredibly important. Grain-fed animals have way too much omega-6. You will generate a state of chronic inflammation in your body if you do that. You will also generate a chronic state of inflammation in your body if you eat an enormous excess of carbohydrates, which tends to be something that a lot of people do, especially if it's prepared food. It's almost certainly full of high fructose corn syrup. This really should be regarded as poisonous. It's that bad for people's health. So people do need to think, what am I going to grow? What are my nutritional needs? How can I avoid creating a state of chronic inflammation? Because that is a massive heart attack risk. And if we're not going to have a healthcare system the way we have now, we seriously have to take responsibility for our own health. We have to do that which does not generate a need for massive amounts of healthcare. Some people will simply be unlucky anyway, but you know, if you look at populations, Aboriginal populations, there's no heart disease, there's no cancer, there's no diabetes, there's no obesity, there's nothing like that. These are the diseases of civilization that we have inflicted upon ourselves primarily by eating industrial food-like substances. And so we need to move away from that. The more we can take control over what we eat, the better. We are going to have to look at sources of dietary fats. That's going to be incredibly important. That is something that most people are not thinking of when they're thinking of food storage. It can be difficult to store, but dietary fats are something you simply cannot live without. So, I mean, it could be an animal source, it could be a nut source, hazelnuts and things like that. Definitely think of woody agriculture, by the way. We have nut trees, we have fruit trees. So there are a lot of things you can do to provide for the things that you're going to need. And we have made a start on that. I don't pretend that we produce everything that we eat. But we at least are learning how, and we could scale up what we do. Or at least when I stop doing what I do now, that is. And right now I'm never there. But my kids are starting to take over doing a lot of the growing and looking after the animals. So this is definitely, it is doable. And we have 40 acres, but we do not use 40 acres for the purpose of self-sufficiency. We don't even use two. I mean, we have a really large vegetable garden and a nice sort of paddock, which is probably somewhat under 2 acres. Then we do our hay, of course, which is probably about 5 or 6 more acres. But to merely be self-sufficient, you don't have to have a farm. You don't have to have 40 acres or even 10. No. You can do a lot with very much less land than that. Another thing to bear in mind if you have kids, like I do, is what do you tell them and what are they going to do with their lives? Well, I've been telling my kids have heard it all. They really have. And you know, they were a captive audience, so they had no choice. So they really have, at least intellectually, taken it all on board. And they have heard from day one, you are not going to take on any debt. You are going to acquire practical skills. And you're going to study at home, because that way it's affordable. And you will study if, and only if, you win a scholarship. So they did that. And I have 2 of them off at university now. Had we been Americans, we've been living in the States, I would have said, no, you're not going to college, come what may. Unless you get a free ride, you're not going to college. Because there's no way it makes sense to dig oneself into a massive debt hole the way college almost everywhere here requires, unless you get a free ride. In Canada, it's simply cheaper. I mean, especially with scholarships, it's a matter of $1,000 or $2,000 a year. So it is doable there in a way that it's not doable here. People need to think about how doable this is, and absolutely no debt. It's incredibly important to avoid taking on debt. Because as a student, you don't even have an asset to sell to pay that debt off. And if you're in a debt hole, somebody may come along and say, well, you know, we'll forgive your debts if you go and fight our resource wars in Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan. Don't go there. That you don't want your kids in that position where somebody has a hold over them. Now, when it comes to practical skills, there's a big range of practical skills. My eldest is in primary health care. She's training to be a massage therapist at this point. She's going to go from there into nursing. She wanted to do the massage therapy first because that is a completely, it's something that's completely uninvasive and does not require medications or anything fancy. All you need is a table. You can get people going. People who are doing a lot of manual labor, perhaps that they're not accustomed to, are going to find they have all sorts of physical problems. It's a huge skill to be able to get them moving again. But she would like to then take that into nursing and maybe be a midwife or a nurse practitioner. Basic skills are good. I would not have encouraged her to go to medical school. It's vastly too expensive. And in any case, most of what you end up learning, you're not going to be able to use, because people aren't going to be able to afford the surgeries, the drugs, the equipment. It simply isn't going to work. So there's not much point in using up the brain space for that beyond a certain point. So find the happy medium with a practical skill. You don't have to take it to the nth degree and be the ultimate professional, but a skill that's partway there is probably the best compromise. I would say you're into diminishing marginal returns if you go beyond that. So if you go to medical school, I'd say that's where you are. If you're a nurse, you're probably just about at that happy medium. My middle child is an opera singer, which is not the most obvious practical skill. However, it is a practical skill. It takes years and years and years to acquire it. And whether he makes it as an opera singer or not, and he probably will because he has a fabulous tenor voice. But if he doesn't make it as an opera singer, he'll be a traveling bard, he'll be a clown, anything. He has a Monty Python-esque sense of humor. Really entertaining people very rarely starve to death. So that is an option. You know, it is an option for some people who don't necessarily have practical skills. I mean, my son has the least clever hands just about of anyone I've ever met. If he had to survive on practical skills using his hands, he would starve to death. But you know, fortunately, he has something else that will be worth something to people. So this is his choice of practical skill. The nice thing about practical skills is you might start them in a formal training setting, but if for some reason that ceases to be possible partway through, there's nothing that says you have to finish them that way, but you can still finish them. Plenty of other people in the world who already have those skills, apprentice with them. At some point, no one's going to ask if you have a piece of paper anyway. You know, if you work in healthcare, at some point people will simply say, "My child is sick, can you help?" And if the answer is yes, they're not going to ask if you have a diploma. So you can start the formal way. If you can finish the formal way, fine, provided you didn't have to get in debt to do it. If you can't, apprentice with somebody. Pick up the practical skills the rest of the way, without digging yourself into debt. So it's another way of being flexible. My youngest was only just started high school. She, at the moment, thinks she would like to be a carpenter, but because she's only in grade 9, it's too early to tell exactly where she's going to go. But very much think in terms of what you tell them and where you guide them to go, because it can take a long time to guide them. You kind of have to work on them when they're young and malleable. If you don't start until they're teenagers, it's a lot harder. They have a lot of expectations. And one of the things we wanted to do with having a farm was to get them out into the country and drastically lower their expectations. And so we did. And so they didn't have television, they didn't have computer games or anything like that. For them, fun was board games, card games, taking the dogs for a walk in the fields. And they simply learned to live that way. And if you can be happy that way, then you can be happy under almost any circumstances. We do not have to have what we currently have to be happy. It simply isn't necessary. We've come to expect it, but people can be happy with drastically less. There was a wonderful program on BBC about 10 years ago called All Our Children. And what they'd done is they followed a whole group of 10-year-olds from different countries for a year to see what their lives were like. And the one thing they had in common was every single one of them was happy. Even the kid whose family lived in a corrugated iron shack on a garbage tip in Manila, and their job 7 days a week was to pick through the garbage heap and see if they could find something they could sell. And they were so excited when they found a little bit of this or that was going to get them more than they normally would have. And it's amazing what you can be happy with. It's about expectations. It's not what we have, it's what we have relative to what we expected to have or hoped to have. If we can make our expectations realistic, then we can meet those expectations. There's a hell of a lot we can do. We can't have business as usual. We have to get over it. It is gone. It is done. We can't have that. We have to be happy with what we can have. And that is really what it means to be human. And that is incredibly important. And that's the message I'd like to leave you with. Thank you.